Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the K Thompson Live Show. I am the son. My name is Eric. And you are?
K Thompson, and as you said, this is K Thompson Live. And we're going to be talking about a number of different subjects tonight. And, I'm glad to be on the air once again. And it is cold, Eric. I mean, it is absolutely freezing.
Yeah, it's pretty cold outside. In the background, maybe you can hear a little Miles Davis. But it's cold on the East Coast. A large part of the country is in a snow blanket, and particularly in the Midwest and other areas in the country.
And also the northern part of the state, New York, and all kinds of cities. And this is, I was understanding when I was listening to the news that this is very unusual for the entire country. Yeah, because there is snow in, you know, like upstate New York and in Buffalo, and there have been buses stopped, and a lot of the transportation is stopping in different areas. But here in New Jersey, where we are, you know, we haven't seen any snow yet. Knock on wood, right?
Right. Yeah, we haven't seen any snow. But even though it is wintertime, they said that a lot of the places that are being hit, it is the extreme for this time of year.
Yeah.
And it's making records in certain areas, parts of the country. So
yeah, the globe itself is going through changes. Let's face it, you know, it's a strange thing that we're going through with all this snow, because it is early for it. I don't know if this ever happened like this before, with so much snow all around the country. So it's unusual, and it has caused a whole lot of traffic problems in New York and New Jersey. Not necessarily so much in the area that we are. But New York State, and with the buses, and wow, it's just absolutely awful. There have been teams of kids, you know, out going to play different games in different cities and states, and they're stuck on the highway. So, you know, it's not a good situation up to this particular point. But we do have a good show tonight. You know, as a matter of fact, let's talk about the hot-button issues right now. I hate to even mention it, you know, but the information about Bill Cosby is really distressing.
Yeah, it's getting a little bit more disturbing the more information comes out, and the more people realize the details, the alleged details, and the number of women is really kind of, if you have one person accusing you of that, but when you have multiple people, they say it's a number as high as 13 people, women, accusing him of sexual harassment and rape and stuff like that. So it's not a good thing, especially if you grew up on Bill Cosby, like a lot of people my age did.
The Huxtables.
Yeah, the Huxtables and all of his other shows, even before that, that go back to the 70s and 60s. Yeah. I Spy and a couple other TV shows he had in there, Fat Albert cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Bill Cosby was the father figure for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And now, you know, as I was listening to, you know, television, watching television a while ago, you know, he has been canceled. You know, so many of the shows that were going on there and canceling them left and right.
Right.
So it's really distressing to hear the story. The first time I heard the story, it was on a radio show. I forget which station that it was on, but it was really, really very distressing, because he was known as the perfect father and the perfect black family. And for this to happen at this particular point, especially in his career, and having everything drop, they're canceling his shows left and right.
Right. When you
even
say,
the new one.
Right, that's when you say canceled. Yeah. The old repeats of old Bill Cosby show, those have been canceled, taken off the air by the Nick at Night, I heard. And that's what you're referring to, be canceled. And then the upcoming projects you have, one with Netflix and one with the NBC to come back to TV, another sitcom. Those projects were canceled as well. So really disappointing to hear that about.
Really distressing. And also now we have the problem of the Republicans being so much against, like, this is new information about Obama, with the whole sign the immigration, you know, documentation about, you know, the people coming in and allowing them to be, you know, coming into the country. And I don't know what's going to be happening with that. But he is going to be signing this so that we will be able to, or the country will be able to have these people in the country, mainly from, I think, Mexico and some of the South American countries. And it's a whole big problem. But Obama said that he was going to be dealing with immigration issues. You cannot actually send people back, you know, to a country where there's danger, where they might be killed, and, you know, this kind of thing. So it's that we're in the midst of a real changeover, I say. And, you know, I want to get into this later on, you know, with Dr. Leonard Jeffries, who's going to be on, because the fact that the mere fact that we are having so many different people coming from different countries, that's going to change what happens with, you know, the school system. Because before, you know, there was, you know, the emphasis on Black American studies. Now we've also have to include studies about the different other cultures that's coming into the country, and there are a whole lot of people. And they should be allowed in, because there will be jobs for them. There are jobs for them now. So, well, a lot of people object to that, but, you know, immigration is going to happen under the Obama administration, and Republicans should, if they can't come up with a better solution, you know, then they're just going to have to, you know, go with the program.
Yeah, you have to do something about the particular problem, and I believe we have our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, joining us in the conversation here. Wayne, how are you? What's your thoughts about the president's decision to take an executive action about the immigration?
Wayne, are you there?
Dr. Page on? Yes.
Yes, hi there. How are you?
I am wonderful. How are you?
Good, fine. We were just talking about the hot topics, which we usually do at the top of the show, Cynthia. So, but, you know, I was just getting ready to introduce you because of the fact that, you know, with all, I would imagine that your office is going to be the recipient of the new tide of people coming into the country.
Okay, let's take a moment and bring the audience up to speed. Who is Dr. Cynthia Page? Why don't you introduce Dr. Page?
Yeah, Eric, I sort of forgot that for a minute. Excuse me, Cynthia. Dr. Cynthia Page, she is the head of the New Jersey Family Medicine. What is the name of your, it's Cypress Hill Institute. Is that what, Cypress Health Institute? Is that what it is, Dr.
Yes.
Page?
That's correct, Cypress Health, yes.
Yeah, family medicine. And what I really wanted to talk to you about was and is acupuncture. And the reason why we wanted to talk about that was because of the fact that all these injuries with people playing, with the kids playing football and whatnot. And I think, you know, I was really thinking about that because of the situation down in South Jersey, you know, with bullying and whatnot. But that also led me to, you know, think about all these injuries that the kids were going through. And with acupuncture that you do, can you explain that to people?
I can. So acupuncture is part of traditional Chinese medicine, and in traditional Chinese medicine, it includes acupuncture, herbal medicine, and qigong, and basically looking at how to live a balanced life. And so we use acupuncture a lot now for pain management, infertility, and some gastrointestinal disorders as well. So it's definitely something that can be used in children. In China, it's used in children a lot. In the U.S., we use it more in adults. But it's definitely a type of therapy that can be used in adults and children for pain management.
Yeah, and the discipline of acupuncture has come a long way in the West within the last 25 years, would you say, Dr. Page?
I definitely would. So traditional Chinese medicine in the U.S. became more popular around the era when Nixon was president. It became popularized because a journalist had gone to China, and while he was there, he had appendicitis, and he had surgery to have his appendix taken out, and all they used for pain management afterwards was acupuncture. And so he became enthralled with its ability to treat pain, and then we started using it more for heroin addiction as well. So at Lenox Hospital, which is now closed, it was used a lot in managing people, and different protocols were developed for different types of addiction as well. So it has been popularized in the past several years. For me, it was one that had a lot of science behind it. And teaching at the medical school, I wanted to be able to teach different types of complementary therapy that had some evidence behind their ability to work for different diseases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let me just take a moment to welcome our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, to the show as well. Wayne, if you wanted to...
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good evening, and forgive my tardiness. I don't even want to explain my other life. Had me preoccupied for a minute there, tenants, you know. But I just want to say good evening to the doctor, and I just got a little bit of what she was discussing with respect to the therapies in terms of alleviating pain. And I'm just curious if I might, and hopefully if I'm, I hope I'm not being somewhat late with this, but there's such a controversy now going around about the use of medicinal marijuana, and I wanted to get the doctor's take on that.
Well, yeah, actually, it's so interesting. Medical marijuana is something that can be used quite effectively for pain management. So right now, there are about 15 states that allow medical marijuana usage. New Jersey is one of those states, and it is somewhat constricted with regards to its use. Primarily in New Jersey, it can be used for cancer, it can be used for terminal illnesses, more severe types of illnesses, not so much for common low back pain, knee pain, and those types of ailments. But medical marijuana in different forms is quite effective. And what's interesting as well, if you look at how acupuncture has been used along with different types of herbal preparations, not so much marijuana, but something that actually smells like marijuana, which is mugwort or artemisia, or what we call moxa in Chinese therapy, combined with needle acupuncture, moxibustion works absolutely beautifully as a means of decreasing pain. We believe it works through decreasing one's pain fiber function, and so if you can diminish the firing of our nerve endings that cause pain, then you can reduce pain. And medical marijuana does that, acupuncture does that, and several other things that have many side effects will do the same thing.
What about the hallucinogenic aspect of taking marijuana? I think there's a way that you could extract it. I'm not sure.
There are. So marijuana has different components to it. And there is one form, so there's THC and there's cannabinol. And within that, you have different strains of marijuana that have different amounts of those two substances. There are different products on the market, more in Europe, where they try to extract out just the parts that actually reduce pain without causing the euphoria and the other psychoactive properties of the medication, or that we can call it a medication since it's medical marijuana, of that substance. And they work to varying degrees. Some people find that the ones that are more pharmaceutical type medications do not work as well as medical marijuana. I love New York's program where they basically said you can have medical marijuana, but it cannot be dispensed in a form that can be smoked. So smoking in any form is going to harm your lungs. So I was really, really impressed with their health department where, you know, and their legislators where they came out to say you can use it, but it has to be in more edible forms. There are other ways of taking it. There are creams and salves that can be used as well. And so that really does take out a lot of the psychoactive properties of medical marijuana, and it does not allow people to smoke, which is harmful to your lungs no matter what you're smoking.
Do you think it will be just as popular as acupuncture at some point?
Well, with the use of marijuana in general in the United States, it'll probably be more popular. But again, you know, it does have side effects. You know, and so when you're, it does affect memory. Smoking does affect lungs, and so there are, and it does affect, it may affect judgment somewhat as well. So there are some negative aspects. Just like if I gave someone a prescription for hydrocodone or oxycodone, which are other narcotics, they also have side effects. So with those medications, I'm advising people, you know, take it when you're home, don't go out driving, don't try to go to work, don't operate heavy machinery. And I think the same thing has to happen when you're using medical marijuana or any other substance that affects your ability to think normally or the way that you would think without it.
And I have to say, But I did try acupuncture some years ago. As a matter of fact, when I first heard about it, you know, Wayne Noble, that was when we were up there at WLIB, and it worked quite well. You know,
I love about acupuncture, because I can typically, when I'm using it, by the time the person gets off the table, they feel better than they felt prior to getting onto the table without side effects.
I'm just thinking of a picture, of myself. I was sitting and waiting to go on to the show on WLIB radio, and the doctor was there, and she was doing acupuncture, and she had put the needle to the top of my head. So one of the owners of the Inner City Broadcasting said, "Oh, are you, you know, are you communing with people in outer space?" It was so funny, but I had a headache that day, and it really worked.
It works beautifully for pain, and you're absolutely right. I can take away a headache probably in about 1 to 2 minutes just with acupuncture.
Wow.
How do people get in touch with you, Dr. Page?
Well, my practice is in West Orange at 405 Northfield Avenue, and our telephone number is 973-669-2820. That's 973-669-2820.
Okay. All right, let's go through that again. This is Dr. Cynthia Page I'm talking to, and we're going to be talking to her again. And she is located in West Orange at, what is the address again?
405 Northfield Avenue.
405 Northfield Avenue in West Orange. And you can get in touch with her by calling 973-669-2820. That's 973-669-2820. Will you join us again, Dr. Page? Just a minute.
I will. It was my pleasure.
I just was wanted to ask Dr. Page. We were talking, wondering where within the Obamacare healthcare program is acupuncture recognized? Is that something that works within that program? How is from your perspective? How is Obamacare affected
It depends on which health insurer you sign up with. And so the health insurance company that usually accepts and pays for acupuncture the most is usually, you know, Horizon will pay, Aetna will pay at times. So it really just depends on which insurance plan you have. And, you know, there are silver, bronze, and all of the other colors of metal in there. And so it depends on which plan you sign up for, and you have to really ask that in advance to see if they're actually covering it and what percent they cover it and for how many treatments will they cover. So each plan is completely different, which is a challenge with our Affordable Care Act in general, is that it still puts a lot of confusion out there because you have to choose between all the different plans, and so you have to really be careful, and you may have to make some phone calls.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah, so much paperwork to go through also. But it's worth
it. It's a lot. I mean, I'd rather have insurance than not have insurance. I just can't imagine having insurance, because things happen. And so everyone needs insurance of some type. And so for me, I think it would be worth it to just go through the process.
Last question. With the kids playing football, with them playing soccer, you know, the touch sport, sometimes they fall and they break things, or they're, you know, they really get into some physical difficulty at times. Do you advocate acupuncture for the children? And if so, how do they react to it?
It depends. In the U.S., again, people are a little different. When I did some acupuncture in Japan and China, children were treated extensively, especially in the summer months. And so acupuncture can be used in children, and it's just a matter of the acceptance of the parent and the child, but it can be used in children as well.
Wow. Dr. Page, thank you so much for this information. Can we do it again?
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Take care. Have a good night.
You too.
You too.
All right.
Thank you. Yeah. Interesting information. I think we have standing by Dr. Len Jeffries. So we're going to be going right to him. That was really interesting with Dr. Page, because I really believe in acupuncture, even with the little legal, you don't even feel him. Not at all. Yeah. It's so teeny that you don't even know when they're in, and when they're in the top of my head, it was absolutely foolish, because it looks so funny. But anyway, let me see if we can get in touch with Dr. Jeffries. Dr. Jeffries, are you there?
Oh, Dr. Jeffries is on the line, Kay Thompson.
Hello. Dr. Len Jeffries, how are you?
Yes, I'm fine. I'm doing well.
Yeah. My son Eric is here, Dr. Jeffries, and also Wayne Gilman is here, so we're all going to be having a good conversation about education.
Good evening, Doctor.
Hey, Dr. Jeffries, how are you today?
I'm glad to be on the air with part of my extended African family. I won't tell you how far back Kay and I go, but it's a ways back when we were young. So it's certainly a pleasure to be with those that are helping her continue her professional work. So I'm delighted to be a part of what you're doing. And luckily,
Wayne Gilman,
my health.
Wayne Gilman,
say that again.
Oh, yes. Right. Good evening, Doctor. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I'm doing fine. I just came in from New York. We're putting together a big program this weekend, and so I had to go to the National Black Theater to sit down with the folks and lay out what we're going to do. But for an old man, part of the Over the Hill gang, I'm moving around the world with power and dignity and majesty, putting the word out and trying to deal with the serious education that our people need. We need an acupuncture treatment in terms of education. Yes.
You know what I wanted to talk to you about, Dr. Jeffries, and that is the new direction of African American studies. And the reason why I'm saying new direction is because of the numbers of people who are coming into the country, from different places. Is that going to affect African American studies? Is it going to be handled, side by side, so to speak? What is going to be the studies or how does that affect the African-American study departments in different school systems?
Well, clearly, African-American studies or African studies was moving in the direction of expanding its reach. In the 60s, we were talking about the African-American experience, but while we were doing that, the African experience was exploding on the scene. The Caribbean-Brazilian experience was exploding on the scene, so our basic course in African American studies at City College was African heritage and the African American experience, African heritage and the African Caribbean Brazilian experience. So we were prepared for the expansion of the reach of these studies. And in the 90s, 80s and 90s, we had reached a point where we were talking about Africana studies being a part of a multicultural look at the world. It included Native American studies. It included the studies of the Asian community. It included the studies dealing with the Arab community, so that we were prepared for the expansion of the reach of African American studies, African studies, because as my wife would say, Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, and she always says that we are the parent people. And when you look at any scientific understanding of the development of the human family, we're there, and everything else springs off of and out of us. And so the same would be with the studies. If you're going to talk about human origins, you got to go back to Africa. If you're going to talk about the development of early cultures, you've got to go back to Africa. If you're talking about high cultures and civilization, you've got to go back to the various river valleys in Africa and out of Africa into Asia. So that we're actually putting the learning process in its correct posture by moving way beyond African-American studies. We don't begin in slavery. That's a part of the journey that our people have experienced. The folks in the Caribbean don't begin in slavery. You go back to the beginning, and if it's not Native American, it's African. And but then there's a cultural mix because Asians and others were brought into the Caribbean. After enslavement, the British brought people from Ceylon and southern India. So when you talk about Trinidad and you talk about Suriname and you talk about Guyana, you're talking about a culture that's mixed with the African and the folks from southern Asia. So that dynamic that's taking place fits well. My wife is in the School of Visual Arts. She's been teaching there for 40 years. She has two major courses, one African-American studies and the other the question of race and ethnicity. And she says the students coming from Asia and other places are all excited about the involvement and the relationship to African-American studies. So it's exciting times if you can make your adjustment, but if you're stuck still in the civil rights movement, then that's not going to allow you to be a part of the new dynamic.
Yeah, you know, let's see. I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, you know, over there at the radio station, and he wrote a book, and I know you're familiar with it, They Came Before America. And
They Came Before Columbus.
Yeah, They Came Before Columbus. And it was actually fascinating. Yeah, I think I should say this. Just recently, within the last month or so, I happened to pick up a history book that is being used at one of the high schools here in New Jersey. And the name of that history book is The Enduring Vision of, let me see, The Education of the American People. And it's by Paul Boyer and Clifford. Somebody wrote that. It's by D.C. Heath and Company. And I was really amazed to read that they started with, you know, Africa. Because I hadn't been, you know, I hadn't read that before, and I taught history. But we were, you know, when we were teaching history a long time ago, you know, we were talking about Christopher Columbus and all that kind of stuff, you know, and Africa did not exist.
Right. And not only talk about Christopher Columbus, October the 12th, we was parading up and down Broad Street in North New Jersey honoring him. When our Native American ancestors are probably turning over in their graves and their mounds. Because here we are honoring a person who opened up the destruction and the genocide of the Native Americans.
And he was also talking about the importance of Mexico. Africans went to Mexico.
Yes. Well, that's what the distribution of the African population was has not been fully understood, but the early distribution of the African population and the early movements go back in the prehistoric times, actually millions of years ago and hundreds of thousands of years ago. Modern humanity marched out of Africa and peopled the world. And so the one that we usually think of in terms of a diaspora is the one that involved the enslavement system, which distributed Africans throughout the West Coast, including Mexico, Peru, Argentina. Certainly Brazil had the largest population comparable to the U.S. population, all of the islands of the Caribbean, and whatever nationality was involved in colonization, Danish, American, French, Spanish, as well as Dutch. So we need to see the global aspects of education and not limit it to a national perspective of the U.S. in terms of its borders. And
I know, if you don't mind, Dr. William Gilman here, I heard recently that and the professor up at Harvard University, who does a lot of research on ancestry period, had
yes.
mentioned. I see his face. Can't think of his name. I'm having a senior moment.
No, it's Dr. It's a good friend. He's a friend. Dr. Henry Louis Skip the Truth Gates. He's the head of African American Studies at Harvard, and he was on my wife's dissertation committee. One of the professors when she got her PhD from Yale. He's the most prominent African American historian at this point, but a lot of it, unfortunately, is commercial. A lot of it is very valuable, and all of it is something we need to look at and appreciate. So he's the new boy on the block, but he's standing on the shoulders of the Dr. Benz, the Dr. Clarks, the Dr. Ivan Van Sertima's, the Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's, the Dr. Wade Nobles, the Dr. Asa Hughes. In the Caribbean, you have Dr. Walter Rodney, Dr. Tony Martin,
right.
and even Dr. Eric Williams, who became the prime minister, was an
of Trinidad and Tobago. Yeah.
Of Trinidad and Tobago. So
right.
He's standing. He's a Johnny come lately, but he's well financed, and so he's doing some significant work. But not enough of the deep work, and I would like to sit down with him and say, Skip, you're skipping the truth. Let's get down to the deep work that you need to do. And he's overlooking the African component of the history in a significant way.
Do you think that's by design, Doctor, if you don't mind?
He's making money. He calls himself an intellectual entrepreneur. And he knows what the white community wants, and he's prepared to deliver it. And his great book on the wonders of Africa starts off with the first sentence that I have taught courses in African history, but I am not a scholar of African history.
Oh.
Well, if you're not a scholar of African history, why are you deconstructing
exactly.
Dr. Ben Clark, Dr. Chancellor Williams, and all of the greats? And so there's a political thing there. So when you see him and you see the great work he's doing, understand there's a powerful political force that's trying to neutralize this explosion of information that African people are not inferior, they're not lesser. They are the foundation of the human family. High culture and civilization is their great contribution to the world. So that is what has been established with the great work that has been going on for the last 30, 40, 50 years. And he is trying to neutralize it by saying we can't forget the Greeks and we can't forget the others. Well, we haven't, but the Greeks worshipped the Africans. The books by the Greek scholars was that they were inspired by what the Africans were doing in the Nile Valley. So
right.
The trick is make the Africans in the Nile Valley who were black and brown, make them black and brown white people. And that's the game that's played now.
Yeah.
And it seems to be pretty fashionable. I one thing that I was trying to allude to when I was calling his name is that he had mentioned how the Africans had a tremendous influence in the Spanish Empire when it, with respect to Mexico, and I never knew. I knew that there was African ancestry there, but I didn't know to what depths. The way he had explained it, you know, and I gather there is some truth in that.
Yes, there are strong still to this day strong African roots in. Particularly in southern Mexico, when you're dealing with the whole Yucatan Peninsula, you're talking about a culture that Dr. Van Sertima says was inspired by the African, and that's why he had his book, It Came Before Columbus. He explained the movement of African fleets across the ocean to help the indigenous populations. So you had the multiculturalism at that period of time, which he attributes to some of the success of the great empires of Central America, and Mexico is a part of that.
I think I can attest to the African influence in Mexico. Several years ago, when I was in Mexico, we happened to be going around to the various smaller, outskirts of Cancun and we went to Tulum and a few other places. And I actually saw big statues. When I say big statues, I mean big heads that were you know, carved that were almost like the size of small houses, you know. And lo and behold,
yes,
they had African features. Okay, and where we were in Mexico, and I forget the name of this village, you know, there were people who were very, very black, you know, and they were Mexicans. Okay, so,
right,
you know, I actually saw the statues and saw some of the people, yeah, you know, and some of them are here in the United States. But I actually saw, you know, those statues. And when I talked to them and had the opportunity to interview Dr. Van Sterber, I was absolutely amazed.
And he was in the forefront of letting the world know that those famous heads, the Olmec heads, that are found all around Central America, in Mexico, and the neighboring countries, Honduras and whatnot, he did a study on them, and he did the braiding in the back of the hair. It's a traditional African braiding, and of course the features, broad features. So he was one who made it a point as part of his mission to contribute to the great awakening of the African world experience. To link Mexico to that. And it's almost like, unfortunately, though, it's almost like when they discover something in Egypt and they find out that it's something black, some people have gotten to the point where they cover it back up, you know, put it back in the ground. So the same thing with Mexico. They find these heads and they say, oh, we've got a great find. And they start digging and digging and digging. Here comes this African out of the soil of Central America. So it's a fantastic historical drama for me. I've enjoyed it for the last 50 years. So I will go to my rewards with a smile on the face. And people say, that Negro is crazy. He's just grinning and grinning all the way to the grave. And it's because this knowledge just exploded on the world. And we need to institutionalize it so it speaks to the world's learning and understanding and destroys that process where black people are considered inferior, and a lot of that inferiority systemic processes we've inculcated. And so it's like Michael Jackson. Here is a beautiful youngster, nice broad features, beautiful brown color, and he grew up wanting to transform himself eventually to Peter Pan. So we need study Michael. I mean, that nose that he eventually put in place of his African God-given nose fell apart, and that contributed to his misery in the end, and the difficulty with drugs and all medicines and whatnot. And so he didn't need to bleach himself, or they say he had an illness, but the illness is that African people everywhere suffer greatly from a shattered consciousness and a fractured identity. And our great psychiatrist, Dr. Wade Nobles, has made that clear, that that's a reality. Even our greatest are still trying to deal with their Africanness. And I mean the greatest and the richest. Our great sister, who is the richest black woman on the planet, from what I understand, and certainly the most prominent, Oprah, still is dealing with accepting her God-given blessing, you know. But we're working with her and praying for her, you know.
Doctor, if I might, and I'm just curious, because you said something at the beginning of the show, and I wanted to get back to that with respect to, you know, that we should not really focus so much on the civil rights movement. And I understand in what context you meant that. But, you know, I don't know if you've, because you're in and out of New York a great deal and you still have the affiliation with CUNY. What's your take on the de Blasio situation and the kind of whiplash he seems to be going through?
Well, I'm glad you raised it. Dr. Francis Kress-Welzing, one of our great psychiatrists, based in Washington. At one point, she was at Howard University, but she was so prominent that Howard asked her to take a long leave. But she says, if you don't put the question of race in any of the issues that are prominent in this culture and the cultures of the Americas, you really can't put together this whole question of what is happening. De Blasio is on the left. He wants a progressive agenda, but he also has a African Caribbean wife, and that produces the children that are the Obamas of New York City. And so that dynamic plays in very important ways in this culture, because I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and I grew up with in a heavy Italian community, and there are deep resentments of African people that we had to survive. And I'm talking about the Payne brothers in Barringer High School, the Amiri Baraka in Barringer High School, the Jeffries brothers in Africa. So we had to learn how to live with the various groups, but the various groups had difficulty in dealing with us as black people. They wanted us to be Americans, but we wanted to say, yes, we're Americans. We were born and raised in this nation, but we have a deep African root, and we want that respected too. So the lack of respect that the current mayor of New York gets and will continue to get comes from a deep well of systemic racism that is in this culture, and it has never been faced. And that same process is happening with Obama, President Obama. They want to make him a non-person. They won't even let him finish out his 2 years. They want to wipe him out.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't exist, and he certainly, if he existed, he was the worst president ever. And so they have planned to make that a part of the mix before he actually was inaugurated. They said that the first inauguration, there were people meeting to talk about savaging his presidency. And those meetings were planned before he even got in the White House and sworn in, because they don't just come into some spontaneous meeting. They come in meetings prepared. What are we going to do? We're going to make sure that there never is a black president any time again. We're going to make sure that this one has the worst record possible. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they even were jumping up and down about his wife wearing her arms not covered. She was proud to show
right.
off the work that she had done. They should have been worried about her brain, her mind. She graduated from Princeton. That's an institution that white folks in the Maine cannot even contemplate going to. She was following her brother, who had graduated from Princeton, coming up from South Carolina, black folks deep in the American tradition. And then she went on to Harvard University for finishing. It wasn't a finishing school to learn to walk and talk right. It was a finishing school for Harvard Law. She graduated from Harvard Law before the president of these United States. And so instead of giving women credit for having a mind, having a body, and having a sacred womb that produced these two little angels running around the White House, no children have ever been so wonderful in the White House in the history that I know. And here she is bringing in her mother, who had roots in South Carolina. She didn't bring in a nanny from Sweden or somewhere. She had her mother come in to help her raise those children while she fulfilled the role of first lady. That's a story of significance, and they're not going to deal with it. They questioned why she would even take her mother to China when she went to China without the president, and it was a glorious a trip for her. She went with her two children. Her youngest speaks Chinese and spoke to the Chinese president and greeted him in Chinese. So instead of us raising up this as a significant part of what's happened in this drama, we're talking about, well, he didn't get Bin Laden enough, quick enough. He didn't do this medical care thing wrong. He didn't do this. I mean, it's the deep racism in American culture that's manifesting itself. Instead of us moving into a post-racial situation, we moved into a heightened racial situation.
I agree. I think personally what's going on here in New York is it's between de Blasio, the whole Rachel Nordlinger scandal, and Reverend Sharpton today, it's despicable. I mean, I can't think of any white elected official who's ever had to go the kind of drubbing that this mayor's taken on because of his affiliation with these three black people.
That's right. And then you have a mayor who was prominent in the history, Mayor Koch. And there was so much scandals attached to his regime, you would have thought that he would have run away and hid in a closet. But instead, he's, how am I doing? Well, you may be doing pretty well, Mr. Mayor, but your man in Queens is ready to commit suicide for the
suicide, corruption.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's why we need to look at these things in a deeper way in terms of systems. There's a system of white supremacy that controls the economics, politics, and culture, and it's based upon denigrating and trying to dehumanize the African. The poor Native American has been devastated. And luckily, really? African people, because we have enough blood with the Native Americans, we've tried to uphold the Native Americans. But now they're running, they're voting for this oil processing process. And the Native Americans said, we don't want that on our soil. We believe the earth to be mother. We don't want oil spills. And you're running from Canada through the Dakotas and whatnot, going through Native American lands. And so we're not going to respect those treaties. We're just going to run over the African, the Native American population. It's the African population that needs to stand alongside them and say, we understand what these, what this is all about. We came, we were brought to America to be a part of the building of America and a dehumanizing, and we were rewarded with dehumanization. We were rewarded with perpetual devastation of our humanity. Our children now, our young people, particularly the men, are being processed out of the schoolhouses, onto the streets, and into the prison community. So there's a new slave system that has been developed. And it's not by happenstance, it's by design.
Exactly.
Because prison labor is another form of slavery. Is that along the lines that you're thinking, Dr. Jeffries, or the point that you're making?
It's another form of slavery, and it's they're working at regular jobs, license plates, furniture, and desk, and all these things, and they're getting
right.
a pittance enough to allow them to survive in the prison. No real skills that will allow them to come out. And even if they develop skills in the prison, when they go out, they don't have any rights. They don't have any right to vote. They don't have a right to take any significant job. They can't get in the labor unions that have a certain high level of qualifications. So they're actually creating a caste system. Even when you've served your 10, 20, or 30 years, you come out caught up in a caste system. You cannot vote. If you serve your time, why can't you vote? If you serve
yeah.
your time and don't have a record of continuous recidivism, why can't you get a decent job? Why can't you get a job in the American governmental process? This nation was founded not on freedom, justice, and equality. That's the idealism. It was founded on injustice, inequality. And we have to understand that. The government put in place the slave system. The government maintained the slave system. And so they didn't prevent white folks who were slave masters or slave overseers from getting jobs. They got free land out of the American situation. You beat back the Native Americans and you put in place all of these lands that allow you to go west and get 50 acres of land. I know the history of this thing is so devastating. And I, being a person who has spent all his days and nights for the last 70 years since I was a youngster in the Newark, New Jersey schools, I was dealing with this history. And so for me, it's all of the founding fathers were slave master bastards.
Yeah.
Every single
right.
one.
And
even
they were
Benjamin Franklin, let's give him a pass. And Benjamin Franklin had a man slave taking care of his personal needs, and he had 4 to 8 enslaved Africans working in his printing establishment. Benjamin.
Wow.
Thomas Jefferson had 4 plantations, including a common old wife, Sally Hemings, that lived, later she lived in the house, taking care of him, kids mm-hmm. that they produced. Hey, let's deal with this history.
That's true. That's true. His great-grandson, great-great-grandson, is a neighbor of mine in New Rochelle. You know?
Okay.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thomas Jefferson's great-great-great, I forgot how many centuries, but from
right.
that same relationship with the black slave.
Yeah, Sally Hemings. And interesting thing, Jefferson's white wife died in 1782, and he never had another white woman by his side for the next 40 years as he became... the mouthpiece for the Declaration of Independence, ambassador to Europe, Secretary of State, and the president a couple of times around, he never had another white woman by his side because he had this Sally Hemings, who was the half-sister of his previous white wife.
Mm-hmm.
You understand the contradiction?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And when people understand the bloodlines, that's really when they really have a true understanding of how this country was really, I wouldn't say built, because it kind of was built, but it was built by people that were forced into captivity. And it was stolen by people that were already here. So,
they have contracts that are part of this history that were signed in European cities, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Hamburg, London, Bristol, Liverpool, Nantes, Bordeaux in France, and Oporto in Spain, and Lisbon, etc., and in the cities of Italy. Contracts were signed to set up charter companies whose design was to go to Africa, rip off Africans, take arms and whiskey and whatnot to there so you can induce the Africans to do some stupid fighting with their brothers and sisters. And then in those same ships that were chartered out and fitted out in the great ports of Europe, they took African captives after they've had their wars. The Europeans didn't have to go inland. They just give an African a set of guns and weaponry, and you can go now and dominate your brother. And then another European gives the other groups a set. The Fanti gets a set, and then the Asante get a set, and they go produce wars between them. And those captives go in the holds of the ships, or designated to go to Barbados or Jamaica or to Virginia or Newport, Rhode Island. And then in those same ships, the products of their plantations were put into those same ships and sent to Europe. So slavery was a four-way profit system, profit fitting out the ships, profit in setting up slave forts and dungeons along the coast of Africa and getting the captives, profits in going, taking those same ships and dumping the at auction block African populations and the plantations, and then profit-making, then taking the profits of the slave ships back to Europe. So that four-way profit system became the foundation of European development, became the foundation of capitalism, commercialism, and eventually capitalism, became the foundation of nationhood, became the foundation of so-called democracies, the foundation of these revolutions, the American Revolution, the French Revolution. The most significant revolution of that whole period was the Haitian Revolution, and it's a non-event.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't want to deal with the real revolutionaries throwing off a system of oppression were the Haitians. The Americans were trying to get a bigger share of the slave system. The French were going crazy, cutting off people's heads, et cetera, and the Reign of Terror. The real revolution was the revolution in Haiti, in which an oppressed people threw off their chains, destroyed the plantations that they had been worked to death on, destroyed the people on the plantations, and then put up an independent nation with a constitution to respect all humanity that was African on those those isles.
One of the
historical figures was Henri Christophe. That he became, he actually fought in the American Revolutionary War on the side of the Americans, and then he became one of the great leaders after Dessalines. Dessalines was the one who said, burn their plantation houses and cut off their heads. And so that was revolution. Before him, you had Volkmann, the priest, the Haitian Revolution needs studied. Yes.
I wanted to ask, and we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask, that little brief history lesson about Haiti, what happened after they became an independent nation? Because when you fast forward these last couple of hundred years and where Haiti is now, being such a poor nation,
it was planned to be poor. Haiti was so rich, it was the richest thing the French had in the Caribbean. Yeah. It was keeping the French empire together. So how could it be the poor nation now that it is? It's planned that way. Haiti is being punished for having revolted, destroying the plantations, and killing the enslavers and setting up a free nation. And then the Europeans came back after Haiti had defeated the Colon army, had defeated the British army that came to help them, had defeated Napoleon's army, had defeated the Spanish army, and then set up an independent operation. The Europeans came in and they put reparations, indemnities on the Haitian nation, which meant that no Haiti could not have any development. Their wealth was taken out and given to France. So I mean, that history needs to be studied. Haiti was planned just like for 60, 70, how many years we've made sure that a rich island called Cuba does not have a place in the sun. The same thing has been done for a couple hundred years with Haiti.
Right. So what happened was that the European nations came back, ganged up on Haiti, basically what's happening over those years following the revolution, refused to do any type of trade or industry with them, and caused them to become a poor, starving nation. And they charged them reparations for overthrowing these various governments.
That's right. They charged them for all the plantations that they burned, and they charged them for the wealth of the planters that was lost in their bank. So, I mean, it's a devastation. We can't raise reparations. Obama can't. He knows that white folks would go crazy if he raised reparations. None of our political leaders. Jesse Jackson can't raise reparations. King could not raise it, even though he kind of raised it when he said, we're here before the Statue of Lincoln, and we've got a bounced check. So he was talking about the help that we should have been given to help establish ourselves in this nation was not. But none of our leaders can say reparation. And our great leader in South Africa, Mandela, he made his people committed, don't raise reparations. Well, damn, if the people have devastated your land, killed your people, stole your wealth, you can't be repaired and healed. After every war, there's reparations. The Germans paid it to France. The Jews are getting it from Americans. We had nothing to do with the destruction of Israel, the Jewish population in Germany. And the Japanese got reparations for internment. We were dehumanized for 200-plus years, and we can't get a dime. We can't even raise it. Put it on the table. So that's why we have to start to look at these things and start making demands. And coming together like King. He was dreaming in 63. But by 64, the reality was kicking in. By 65, they're kicking in. The murder of Malcolm and other people. By 66, the Vietnam War. 67, he said, I can't handle it no more. And then he planned to march on Washington, not with a dream, but with a reality, the poor people's march. And they were going to sit on the lawn and raise the contradictions. So he had moved to the point of we need to give ourselves reparations as we demand help to put our money in our own banks, withdraw our patronage for this society, and start dealing with some heavy economic questions. And after that, that was his death knell. You're going to mess with America's economics? No, you won't. You're going to be out of here.
Right.
You know?
Right, because I was wondering, I mean, along those lines, it really makes me think of I don't know if you're familiar with Douglas Turner Ward play Day of Absence. And that was the day that black people decided to vote that day. And in response to something like Ferguson or something like that, you know, what if no games, no sports were played, nothing was done? And we.
I wish that I could get to Al Sharpton. But I may have to get to Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory comes from St. Louis. Akbar Muhammad, the associate for Minister Louis Farrakhan that takes care of Africa, comes from St. Louis. They should call for economic withdrawal so there's justice in the St. Louis area, not just Ferguson. They should call for economic withdrawal. Even if they come with some kind of Mickey Mouse verdict, it's clear they haven't change their ideas on what is what. Black people should say, we're going to get our little turkeys, but we're going to be saying some prayers for the Native Americans, and then it's really going to be Black Friday, because from that point on, we are going to put our monies in the bank, in our own banks, and we're going to stop systematically buying in America until things change. That's what King was, you know, that's what Martin Luther King said.
And we're going to have to put it right there, put a period in it right there. Dr. Jeffries, Dr. Leonard Jeffries.
Well, I certainly want to thank all of you, and I certainly want to thank my lovely sister, Kay Thompson. And so anytime you need me to bring a little understanding to the airways on the serious side, I'd be willing to do it.
We will be calling on you again and again, and thank you for this history lesson.
And on the Kay Thompson line, Dr. Jeffries, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, always a pleasure. Wayne Gilman, our other co-host there. Wayne.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, the hour just went by so quickly.
And if anybody wants to meet us personally on Sunday, my wife and I will be at the National Black Theater celebrating the 50 years and talking about legacy. How can we protect the legacy of Dr. Van, Dr. Clark, Gil Noble, Alex Haley, and all of these brothers and sisters? So we'll have a year program of defending and protecting legacy. So it's free for people who want to come, and we'll be glad to see folks there. National Black
Thank
Theater, 125th Street.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffries.
Thank you.
All right, now. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.
Okay.
Join us again next week on the Kay Thompson Live Show. I'm the son, Eric Payne, and you are Eric Payne.
I'm Kay Thompson. Yes.
And that's Wayne Kilman, the hero out there in Brooklyn. We'll see you again next Wednesday. Blog Talk Radio, Kay Thompson Live Show.